If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd a hammer out danger, I'd a hammer out a warning, I'd a hammer out the love between my brothers and my sisters.
If you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long.
Well, welcome to the Labor Beat Radio Show, broadcasting here from Bolivar, West Virginia, sometimes called Harper's Ferry. It turns out that Bolivar was the headquarters of the union. Well, not, it wasn't the headquarters, it was the neighborhood, the housing project of the year-round workers at the Harpers Ferry Armory, which was an early armory established by, I think, George Washington, actually. Anyway, so the full-time year-round workers were on the top of the hill, including the management. And down at the bottom of the hill was the seasonal and temporary workers, which mainly, you know, was winter gathering in the good seasons, you know, wood to fire the foundry they were using to make weapons, you know, cannonballs, etc. And so the kids, it got famous because it turns out the kids that lived in the bottom of what they call the hole of Harpers Ferry. Harpers Ferry is surrounded on three sides by mountains, okay? And two rivers, the Shenandoah and the Potomac, converge right at the point of the town. And anyway, the kids on the top of the hill were called Mudforts, M-U-D-F-O-R-T-S, because of their legendary accuracy with throwing mud balls at the kids that lived on the lower part of town, which were mostly temporary workers and families. So, but unfortunately for the Mudfords, the Stonewall Jackson, the Confederate general, took the town in 1862. And the Mudfords were never heard of again, okay? they went into historical legend, but of course, no one knows where they went. But nonetheless, their legacy is here because about two blocks from me, there's a street named Mudford Lane. And it's what remains of the permanent federal workers' families that were here prior to Stonewall taking the town. Anyway, welcome to the Labor Beat Radio Show. Got my good friend Scott Marshall here, and I'm predicting that J.B. Christensen in retirement has overslept since he hates to get up early. The president of our labor council. Okay, so anyway, I had several efforts to get a hold of two other brothers from the labor movement this morning, but everyone put off until next week. So one is a man I've only met once, but who has a name known throughout West Virginia, apparently, that called Fuzz LaRue, and I think he works with the plumbers and pipe fitters, and I'm not quite sure what county he's in. And the other, of course, is trying to get Josh Seward, the president of the AFL-CIO, and to come on and talk about a very big project that is probably a collection of projects, mostly inspired by the Inflation Reduction Act in President Biden's, well, the Democrats' signature bill that they got passed that includes an immense amount of money for alternative energy development. I mean, big. Because I think that, so for example, there's three projects in West Virginia that are all been initiated, probably with the, probably wouldn't have happened without Senator Manchin's role as chair of the Senate Energy Committee. But it also, West Virginia has, in addition to natural gas and coal under the ground, it has another really very rich resource, and that is clean water. It has more water than practically, I don't know whether they're measuring it per capita. How do you measure water per capita? Whatever. But, or else. But nonetheless, I think it's got the most clean water around. And so it turns out that's entirely, that works really good for a process called hydrogen power. Because really what you have to do is heat water up to a very high temperature and the oxygen and hydrogen separate. And then you can, once you get the hydrogen separated, you can use it. You can make a hydrogen engine, basically, because it burns very fast. And then, actually, once you've got it started, I think it works pretty much without the use of any fossil fuels at all. Although the initial fire-up is done with, it's going to be done natural gas, I believe. All right, so a 1.6, I'm told, billion-dollar project, a hydrogen hub, which would then serve the entire region, you know, which would mean you'd have to build a distribution network with it, which would classify the project as something quite, not quite the same as extraction, okay, because you got a process and you got distribution. It's not quite the same as just taking the oil out of ground, sending it out of state. Almost all the owners live out of state. And, you know, all you can do is charge a severance tax. You know, you took something from the state's natural wealth, you severed it, therefore we're going to tax something per pound. So it's not quite that, and I know that about 8 or 9 years ago, the Brazilian government, this is back in the previous Lula regime, I believe, so it's Lula 1, was going to through Petrogas, was going to build a gigantic hub for the fracked gas, okay. As it turned out, Pennsylvania got the deal, and we didn't, you know. But now it's come back with this hydrogen concept. Plus, there is now a giant battery plant that's going to be set up, and the hiring is being done, I believe, by the United Mine Workers, or some of the hiring. Anyway, so it's going to be most likely a union shop. And then there's, whatever Bill Gates is doing in the state, wanting to convert coal-fired plants to nuclear plants, or some of them, or one of them. I'm not quite sure what. But, you know, I used to work for Gates and Microsoft. And he doesn't do anything. He doesn't have much sense of humor. Or, you know, he doesn't waste much time when money's involved. Okay. So I assume if he showed up in the state, that's a serious project. Anyway, so there you have. And Senator Manchin has made it clear that he would prefer that the jobs be union jobs. So, and he's, you know, I don't know whether he's going to run again as an independent or as a, I don't think he's going to run as a Republican. I don't believe that's Joe. You know, the political wisdom currently in West Virginia is that if you run as a Democrat, you're going to lose. And he's been the only exception recently. So there's that. I have a bunch of labor news this morning, but I was going to give Scott a chance to. We have strikes going all over the place. I mean, the Screen Actors Guild, this unbelievable thing that happened to Rutgers this past week, and you know, and man, talk about, man, the president of that university, when that strike took place, he ran away from that as fast, deal, 2 days into it, you know, so it's interesting. And the screenwriters, and we can go through some of that later. But Scott, welcome to my show, welcome to the show this morning. We'll send JB a little sticker. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. How about you? You look good.
Yeah, well, you know, I do this there beach on the thing. Beaches, well, because the there's a big mess behind. It's a big mess behind me, you know. I mean, I just live here. Carol rearranges the house, you know, and the garden. She's really if you ever travel and you want to get here, we have the most beautiful garden in town. Carol has maintained it, she really has, and she loves it. But the mayor's wife lived here before, and she passed away actually here, and she was the president of the Harpers Ferry Garden Club, you know, which let me tell you is a that's a prestige position in the state. not only that, you know, she was observed by the neighbors 10 o'clock at night, okay, 83 or 4 years old, outside with a headlamp on her head, you know, digging around in her garden. You know, it was like, not only that, if neighborhood kids, you know, were found to be invading her places where she had these unbelievable array of, you know, every 2 weeks the flowers in the garden change. You know, she had it set up so it was like a wave of color that went through most of the summer, right? And she just worked on it. And so if the kids were in the neighborhood, we got anywhere near the flower garden, she would come outside with a shotgun. Yeah, she would come outside with a shotgun. Get the hell out of my. So, anyway, it's been country living here. All right. Well, the first strike I want to talk about this morning is the screenwriters deal. Because it's, you know, everyone that knows that the you've had this streaming services, right, that have just exploded all over the industry. And so I'm going to read a statement by the unions, WGJ Writers Guild Associates or something like that. And it says, driven in large part by the shift to streaming, writers are finding their work devalued in every part of the business. While company profits have remained high and spending on content has grown, writers are falling behind. the companies have used the transition to streaming to cut writer pay and separate writing from production, worsening working conditions for the series writers at all levels. On TV staffs, more writers are working at minimum, regardless of experience, often for fewer weeks or in many rooms, while showrunners are left without a writing staff to complete the season. And while series budgets have soared over the past decade, median writer-producer pay has fallen. How much? By 23% if you calculate inflation. So they got a 97.8 or something strike vote. Contract expires on May the 1st. And let's see, how many workers is this covering? Well, it depends on. Oh, it's 15,000. All across. Wow.
Wow.
That must be, that's really big. Anyway, so there's that. And then, of course, the New Jersey Rutgers University strike. By the way, my wife's dad was once president of that union. And, well, he was a physics professor, and he was the president of the whatever the union, and he got a thrill out of it, you know. I used to talk to him all, but he'd always call me, you know, when he had grievances and stuff like that were piling up about, you know, like people were, the professors were arguing about, well, who gets the desk near the window, and wait a minute, who has the most seniority? All right, yeah. You know, who gets to have how often do you get to have what do you call those things where you take a whole season off and you write your masterpiece or something? Sabbaticals, right? And
sabbatical, yeah.
And you know, so I mean, it was, you know, the usual, you know, shop floor issues, but in a, you know, college context. And so also all the graduate students and everybody went out. Everybody. You know, so that was didn't take long to settle that. Because another issue that's come up, and this is a little bit related to the Silicon Valley Bank or the lack of or insufficient bank regulation. It turns out that college endowment funds have engaged in, well, you now they look like some risky investment practices, okay, in the sense that if you buy a bond if you buy a bond, you know, make a loan, okay, at 2%, and it matures in, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, whatever, or 10, or the short and long, right? And all of a sudden, the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, you know, to way above the rate you were charged or you were paying, you know, to get the bond. All of a sudden, the bond is not marketable at all. Nobody would buy it. It's not worth anything until it fully matures, right? So you can't, but it's on your books as an asset, not a liability. And, you know, it's just, you know, so I think some of the college funds have gotten into that. And, you know, there's an attack across the board on all of the tenure, getting a tenure job position is just almost impossible. It's happened in a lot of places, right? I know the UE is organizing. I think every time I read their newsletter, they're organizing another set of graduate students or adjuncts, right?
Yeah. They're all over the place.
California, I think it's there's also a big campaigns there, you know.
Well, Well, just on your the other point that you made a few minutes ago about the impact of technology on organizing, you know, an interesting thing that's happened recently is that, and I'm not sure, I think it was in Japan, where they now have an assembly line that makes cars from start to finish, from parts to the finished vehicle rolling off, that are never touched by human hands. It's all made by robots.
Right.
And you think about the impact of that on workers. I mean, how many workers worked on that assembly line that aren't there anymore?
That's right.
And the other thing that's changing, and that's in the U.S. too, when these unions have, you know, where they train people, one of the trainings that is most sought after now is robot care, because that's where right. that's where it's going. So, you know, they don't need so many welders anymore, but they sure do need these, and that's yeah. having a huge impact on the labor movement. But back to your original question about strikes, we just had a picket line yesterday for the Starbucks, for another Starbucks that fired somebody for
union activity, right? Yeah.
Union activity for striking. And it's just overwhelming. But, you know, another part of this, which I think is extremely interesting, is that all of the both Amazon and Starbucks are coming up with a demand for a national contract. And when you think about that, in our history, you know, the demand for a national contract in industry was what led to the CIO, basically. It had a lot to do with that. And the fact that they're doing that again now, I mean, that was a huge campaign to get rid of those national contracts, because the companies, you know, they knew how powerful that was.
Oh, yeah,
they
sure.
went after it all over the place, including my union, the steelworkers. Yeah. But now these workers are doing that. And I think one of the things that represents is a really growing awareness in the labor movement of, you know, what they need to have real power against the corporations and the financiers and stuff like that. And that really is a growing movement. And the other thing I would say is that, and we've all talked about this before, but it's incredible the kinds of coalitions that the labor movement is building with all kinds of organizations, including, you know, anti-racist organizations, and, you know, you got unions supporting Black Lives Matter, and you got the women's movement being supported. And it all goes back to the AFL-CIO telling its unions, you know, look, when we go on strike, we go to all these groups and ask them to come help us. That's got to be a two-way street.
Yes, it does.
When these people have a problem, we got to be out there on their part. And they're yeah. doing that. And I think there's just a really, I'm not pessimistic at all about where the labor movement's going. I think it's as strong as it's ever been in my lifetime. I'll tell you that.
Well, not numerically. But
no, yeah, right.
Yeah. So I mean, we have you know, like, well, people talk about the difference, the split, what it called, the distance between the cup and the lip, and that, you know, the national yeah. contract for Amazon workers is, I think I'm going to just walk the limb here and take a little bit of a controversial position with some. As I think the go it alone technique, while I understand the kind of issues that inspires it, is a mistake. And it's one that I think the Amazon movement needs to figure out a way to correct. I mean, they have to figure it out. It's a rank and file movement. It's a powerful movement, at least in the New York area. But and not just there, North Carolina. And there's some other places where there's quite a bit of activity going on. I don't think that, you know, the move to stay independent of the AFL-CIO is a smart one. But, you know, mistakes made. I mean, speaking personally, I can speak of so many early, especially early mistakes that I made that, you know, the blowback was not always immediate, but it eventually got there. So I think that's an important somehow issue yeah. that without starting arguments and getting into stupid fights, you know, or that kind of thing, we try to work that one so that we got a little bit more unity. The other thing is that it's pretty clear to me that, you know, Ford, when the strikes at Flint, right, you know, and the wave of strikes that gave birth to the CIO, especially in auto, we're talking, you know, the mine workers, kind of a separate thing, but in auto, you know, the concentration of workers in a small number of very large plants, okay, made it possible that once you get two or three of those, right, you know, then the demand for a national contract becomes, you got enough of it so that enough muscle so you can make it happen. But now you have, you know, the technology has distributed the workforce, even in the giant companies, right? Amazon, Starbucks, Google, all these, yep. you know, Microsoft. I mean, Microsoft used to be a one that you maybe could have organized because Bill didn't like to have, we always, you had to call him Bill when you worked there, by the way. That was a rule. Anyway, if you got a phone call and they said there was Bill on the phone, it most likely was Gates because nobody else wanted to use that word. I never got a call, but anyway,
all the other bills became Williams, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. But he wanted to have the whole place as a campus, right? You know, so he could, if one project mm-hmm. failed, he could move the people from that over to another project. He didn't like the idea of having to, you know, set all the. He liked to have projects. He knew most of them were going to fail in tech. I mean, most of your hot, bright ideas don't actually make it to market, right? But a lot of you, but you got to have a kind of farm system where you're trying it out to whatever level to see whether it'll fly or not, right? And he would set those things up, and he wanted to have it like a big giant college campus. But then he became a global corporation, and things changed. But so yeah, it's distributed now, and I think that adds to the political requirement. In order that has to shift in order to get victory, okay? I mean, the playing field has to be sufficiently leveled politically, okay? So politically, legally, you know, so you can't get fired for joining, okay? If nobody can be fired for joining, then the movement will spread from 270 Starbucks to 9,000. It will. Okay, I mean, eventually. But you need that. There needs to be this umbrella of protection for that kind of thing to happen.
Absolutely. So,
of course, the minute you have a requirement that's political, then I think your remarks about the importance of alliances, you know, says it all in a way. It has to be a set of alliances, you know, that bring these kind of rights to bear. Same way with Amazon, and differently, even though they're big facilities and you got 1,000 workers in them, Amazon has set them up so they can shut that one down and reroute the traffic to another one.
Yeah. And the drivers and all of that, you know. But another thing that sort of hits on this. In an experience I had in Chicago, I needed to go pick up something for my iPhone, and so I was going to go to Amazon to get it, and so I drove up, and there was a Starbucks right across the street from the Amazon, so I went into the Starbucks to get a coffee, And, you know, they had this, Starbucks has this program of, you know, when you order something, you say union yes for your name so that they would say, and it worked. I've done that in several places. And the baristas, you know, giving you a thumbs up and stuff like that. But anyway, I went into that one and I said that and the barista said, told me, she said, yeah, we're working on it right now. We're going to get it. I said, oh, that's really good. And she said, in case you didn't know, the Amazon across the street is trying to organize too, and we're working together on this stuff and giving each other ideas and stuff like that. I mean,
right.
Come on. That's just that. That's the kind of coordination and cohesion that we need a lot more of.
Wisconsin is it's Wisconsin or Michigan? Which is it? Wisconsin or Michigan that reversed the right to work thing?
I think it was Wisconsin, but I'm not positive.
And one of the two of them. It's yeah. One of the two. Yeah. Anyway, well, so that kind of political shift. Do you know anything about? We should get somebody on from up there actually, to talk about the coalition of non-union of not other than the union that must have been brought to bear for that to pass. I mean, a lot of times, yeah. Right to work is said, oh, that's a labor issue. Yeah, it's a labor issue. but, if you go to the local, some of the other local political events, you don't usually hear right to work on the agenda. So I'm just wondering how that coalition there, how the, other than the unions,
right.
How that happened, you know, that's good. Because if we understood the relationships that came together there, well then that might be a little recipe that would cook a stew other places, you know, mm-hmm. So to speak.
That's a really good idea.
Because I like things that get things where something worked right, and
yeah.
And a lot of times it might be unique in the community or the relationships there, but you know. We're going to have a big, there's going to be a big to do here in the state of West Virginia over these energy projects and, the environmental movement
mm-hmm.
or parts of it, not all of it. I mean, cause I think, Manchin is definitely tipping his hat in the alternative direction here with, electric car batteries and, hydrogen, even though it's fired by natural gas. And by the way, I was talking to a former state senator yesterday, and who thought, "Oh, gee, well, the mine workers and the mine companies, you know, will oppose this because it's not, you know, going to be coal fired, right? Even the startup." And I said, "No, I mean, because Cecil's behind it, because it's related to a just transition, and there's a lot of jobs there. The hub especially is going to that's going to be a pretty substantial employment opportunity right there. So but we're going to have
building all the charger stations.
Yeah,
that's going to put a lot of people to work.
It is. So I think we all up here, and especially in the Eastern Panhandle, it's very difficult to find someone that on the Democrats that likes Joe, but because he did kiss Trump's ass, and that embarrassed me to have him do that, and he also supported that Judge Kavanaugh, you know, who was just how could not anybody not tell while listening to him that he's just he's not for you.
Yeah,
he's not on your side. Whatever it is, but so. But nonetheless, Manchin has a philosophy of opportunism, and he believes in it. If the middle of the road's a sewer, that's where he's going to be.
Well, you know, the thing about Cecil, too, is that, he's the head of that, Labor Committee for a Just Transition, or Labor Committee.
Right, yeah.
Labor Sustainability Committee, or whatever it's called.
Yeah,
and that that has a lot of followers all over the place that are supporting, you know, supporting the just transition, and but also supporting the environment.
Well, I mean, if you have a just transition in place, then the workers will support the environment. I mean, they won't.
Absolutely.
The enemy. It's not their enemy, right? If it's putting you out of a job and saying you have an opportunity to collect the wonderful benefit of unemployment insurance,
that's right. That's
then, you know, that they don't think so good about it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm just, you know. On that,
but you know, that coalition is growing too. You know, the ties between labor and the environmental movement are getting stronger and stronger all the
right.
time.
And I think they have. I mean, I think, you know, there's still some issues there, but but you know, the country. One of the things that's happened is because the divisions in our country, which I believe are ultimately and primarily related to the divisions in wealth and class, is making it has an impact on ideology, right, and on ideas. Everybody tends to get a little more extreme in their, you know, in their judgment. Make you know, mountains out of molehills. People you can say make or but on the other hand, it's hard to tell, you know, you have such sharp negative things going on in different ways, right? Whether it's, you know, the murders that take place, right, the mass killings, or whether it's the you know, the fact that Congress on many issues can't seem to move. Okay, I mean, stuck in nowhere land, even though I mean and you have the Trump and the MAGA phenomenon, which is seems to have lost a little steam. But sometimes I wonder where I think that because I read mass media all the time, and mass media is moved against him outside of Murdoch, pretty much. And where are the people really at? Okay, is still a question. I don't think quite. Still not clear in my view, but. I mean, I don't know why the Democrats have lost so bad in West Virginia. I don't really quite understand that yet, why it got so bad. And why the Koch brothers' efforts to take over the Republican Party here were so successful. I mean, they really run the thing here in the state. So, I don't know.
Well, you know, one of the things... that I think we also have to be clear about is that this is, I mean, that whole MAGA movement is a fascist movement. And that's not an exaggeration. And there's been a lot of good work about tracing the history of how fascism came in Italy and Germany and how, and it in Spain, and how it's how it developed over time. And this wasn't just because of Trump's election. This has been brewing within the Republican Party for quite a long time.
Yep.
And that's a danger that's for real. And I think, I also think that there's a growing awareness of what that danger is in the labor movement. There are more and more people in the labor movement who see that this is that kind of danger.
Well, there is, but there is also, you know, I observe there's a lot of efforts at going on to try and sort of split, to create divisions, you know, in labor. For example, yesterday, I think both the president of the AFL-CIO, I'm gonna generalize a little bit, and if I make a mistake, I'm sure someone will get back to me. But you know, I'll apologize in advance to but I know that the labor leadership in Josh Sword and Andy Waters are both good guys, okay, in West Virginia. they think that politically it's important to not waste money on losers. That's one line, okay, that was repeated. And although it was expressed, let's only put money on winners. And so Josh had a bunch of data, a lot of data analysis, basically, that had been done on alt races throughout the state. And, you know, he said, you know, you have minority positions. For example, in the state of West Virginia, support for abortion rights is a minority position. Not by much, but it's a minority position in the polls. Support for, you know, gun control, even modest things, is also currently a minority position. Mm-hmm. And probably a minority position among labor too. The only except, and there's so for, you know, for example, you get, when you get into the gun control issue, well, you know, you have to say, well, we want to either reduce take away someone's guns, okay, you know, whereas most of, there's a lot of confusion about what's hunting and what's not. And you want to reduce the expenditures on police, but then if police go down, then you get big criticisms from the public about, you know, we have crime, and then we have to, big pressures to increase the police. And so, you know, in government, it becomes like a you can't go anywhere issue a lot. I mean, the sides just don't move. They get jammed up. Yes, we don't want to have any more killings. Oh no, we can't. You know, we don't have the support to take away, you know, weapons. No one's moving on that. Actually, every time there's a killing, someone, the sales of weapons go up. Right. So it's so you get in. So their feeling is that those issues are distractions from what could unite. Mm. Working people, all right? And in a sense, now, I'm not sure I entirely agree with them, because I do remember when Bernie came through and ran in 2016, he did not back up on his positions. Of course, Bernie's never been put gun control first. He never, that's where he comes from, Vermont, remember, okay? he comes from Vermont, my old town there, Springfield. Anyway, so but on some of the, but he didn't back up on the environmental positions, okay? Although, you know, Bernie always, you know, put, you know, the just transition kind of concept first, all right? And attacked the corporations, but he got more votes than Trump in 2016 in the primaries.
Right.
And because he focused on the bread and butter issues, and, you know, the ones that could unite. Exactly. And so I think there are some tactics here that tactical questions that I think are tough.
But you know, John, I think it was CNN just recently, in the last day or so. They analyzed some national polling on these questions. And what was really interesting was that I think 25% people supported the right to an abortion. And that's national. And the same was also true on gun control.
Right.
That a majority, including Republicans, support some form of gun control, and on banning assault weapons, it was even a majority. So that's a kind of, I mean, that's national, of course, and that doesn't go state by state, but it really is kind of an incredible thing that we're moving in that direction on these issues. And it's it's interesting. I have a friend who used to be a reporter in the old East Germany, and he when the whole gun thing came up, he wrote an article that we published in the People's World, about how they did gun control there. And it was really interesting because they said everybody has, you know, this is long before assault. Well, I don't know before, but there weren't mass-produced assault weapons then, but there were rifles and handguns. And they prohibited people could own guns if they wanted them. However, and when they were, they had to lock them up in vaults controlled by the government. And if they wanted to go hunting, they would come and they could take out their rifle and they could go hunting with it and they had to bring it right back.
Where was this?
This was in the old GDR.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
And that's an incredible idea that, you know, if you have to, but I mean, I don't know if they're,
you know,
if we're headed in that direction here, but there are sensible things like keeping them locked up and in your house. And, you know, I mean, you look at the huge number of kids killing themselves with guns from their own home.
Yeah.
It's
horrible.
It's murder. Yeah.
It's terrible. Well, I remember, you know, my family came from Abilene, Kansas, you know, and they were, my dad was a big believer that, you know, why not take the Wyatt Earp approach, which is you can keep your guns, but if you bring them into town, I'm going to hit you over the head with my pistol. Yeah, that's why you had that big long pistol, because most of the guys that were waving their guns around were drunk. And, you know, he usually didn't have to do too
much. Of course, you got to be as old as us to remember the Wyatt Earp part of it.
Yeah. That's probably true. But I asked my dad, I thought, because he was from Abilene, and I said, well, I thought that Wyatt Earp was from Dodge City, you know, or Tombstone. And he said, well, that's true. Yeah. He says, that's true. Abilene actually hired Wild Bill Hickok, to do something about all these cattle drives that came through, right? And the whole town was just turned into a chaos, you know, whatever, when these guys are after months on the trail, okay? But they had to fire him because, he was drunk most of the time, Wild Bill, and when he had problems with people, he started shooting things, and he hit bystanders.
That doesn't still happen today.
He was like, you could have a good rule, but if you have a deranged actor involved, God help you, right? So,
there
I don't know
just
what
one recently a guy in a bar started shooting everybody.
Yeah, I mean,
I can't remember where that was, but it was just recently.
I don't know, but anyway, so I got a lecture about how if I wanted to make a big deal about gun control right now in the state, I might be engaging in a distraction. But nonetheless, All right. Well, I think we've killed it this morning here a little bit, Scott. Okay, and I'll have to find out what happened. I should call JB and make sure he's not unwell. Okay, actually, so
he might.
You know, at our age, this can happen at any time, as you know. So anyway, well, I want to thank. You doing okay? How's your lovely wife doing? Anyway,
she's doing fine.
All right.
And same by you, huh?
Yeah. Oh, Carol's killing it. She's on the National Science Foundation. She's a senior economist there, and she's a member of the union.
Yeah, I know.
She's a member of the union. Okay.
Yeah.
They're represented there. So, and she's
so is Bobby IBEW.
Yeah, and they're working hard on what do you call it? Open source software as a asset that is.
Cool.
Not priced usually. It's not on the account balance sheets of corporations. Yeah. It's like profiles.
Yeah.
You know, all those billion, 4 billion and 4.5 billion profiles that Facebook has, which are massive, by the way, massive profiles. And 4.5 billion of them, and they don't show up on the balance sheet. So who do they belong to?
Yeah, really.
And but right. In a way, it's like the Xi Jinping. He actually said this, the Chinese lead president, right? He said that in an argument with Tencent, which was, I think, was owned, or Alibaba, which was owned by Jack Ma, right, at one point, Chinese billionaire, and about who was going to have all these profiles, and the president of China has a position, well, if you're going to have them, I'm going to have them too. Well, now, I don't know whether the ultimate solution is, but anyway, let's...
sounds like to me.
Yeah, right. I mean, you have a practical problem, right? I mean, for example, how are you going to... Right now, you have everybody using these giant tech companies like Facebook and Google as authentication resources, right? Haven't you seen this thing where you go on and you can either have a username and password? Oh, no. If you have a Google account, just click on that. They will verify to us. We'll be satisfied. If they think you are who you say you are, we'll accept that. All right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's this kind of... And so now... The government has done the same thing for the purposes of doing your taxes online with them, okay? They're going to have a gov.id, and it's a same kind of thing. They're going to verify who you are if they can. Anyway, so...
really crazy.
Yeah. All right, buddy. All right. I'm gonna close with Pete Seeger here.
Yay!
And a Pete Seeger song.
Yeah, I know.
That's sung by Nancy Griffith. All right, and it's called. I think it's called "If I Had a Hammer." Okay.
When the people turn us down, Lord, it's a bourgeois.
Well, that was the bourgeois blues. We got to get there. Here we go. All right, Scott. Hey, can you hear this? Can you hear this music? Okay. Could you hear that music? Okay. Or did it sound staticky?
Just barely.
Yeah, there's a problem with the music on Zoom. That's interesting. God. It comes out on the air okay, and on the tape fine, but when you're listening on Zoom, it sounds staticky, right?
It just sounds like it was breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So there's something going on. Anyway, but that's not true over the air. It's true for the Zoom participants. I don't know why. I got to look. Figure out why that is.
Okay.
All right, take it easy, buddy. Love you. Take care, man. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. I had a hammer in the evening. Oh.